You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm Andrew Day.
And I'm Connor Eccles.
Each week, we break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news. And we interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter on Substack.
So, Connor, this week we've got a lot of important topics to get into, and I want to know now that we are recording this on Friday, January 17th at 10:34 a.m., at least one of the stories we plan to discuss is developing quite rapidly. That story is about Trump's role in getting a ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas. We'll also be discussing some unintended consequences of the TikTok ban, how the use of artificial intelligence by police has led to wrongful arrests, the Senate confirmation hearings of some of Trump's cabinet nominees, Trump's surprisingly high level of support in the global South, and how the Mexican government is responding to Trump's plan to bomb the cartels. Then we'll have a deep dive discussion about the new ceasefire agreement in Gaza and why it eluded the Biden administration for so long. And after that, we'll be talking to our boss, Robert Wright, about Trump's looming presidency and about artificial intelligence. But now, to our news bites, what is the first story you want to talk about, Connor?
Yeah, so I wanted to lead off with some updates about the confirmation hearings of some members of Trump's incoming cabinet. I'll start with Pete Hegseth, who is, of course, the nominee for Secretary of Defense. He's a former soldier in the U.S. military, also a Fox News host who's had a certain relationship with Trump in the last few years. Most of the hearing really focused on some of his controversial views around the role of women in the military and similar issues. But I wanted to highlight something that's got a little bit less coverage, which was when he told the Senate Armed Services Committee that, quote, restrictive rules of engagement in conflict make it more difficult to defeat our enemies, end quote. And he pledged to stop lawyers from, quote, getting in the way of U.S. military operations. So this is really interesting because, you know, Hegseth has faced a non-trivial amount of criticism for his really impassioned defense of U.S. soldiers who had been accused or even convicted of war crimes that occurred during the war on terror. This is a fairly clear signal that if he is indeed confirmed, and he is expected to be at this point, that he will not be very focused on, let's say, a strict adherence to some of the more complex laws of war and things like that. So that is something that we will follow closely, no doubt, during the Trump administration. I also wanted to talk about John Ratcliffe, who is Trump's nominee to lead the CIA. He was the director of national intelligence during Trump's first term, and in that position advocated for much greater confrontation with China, and he is pushing to do so again, as he is expected to take over at CIA. He argued in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee that the CIA has, quote, got to play a role in disrupting our adversaries' technologies so they don't get ahead of us, in response to a question about how the U.S. should be dealing with China. And so we can expect from his comments in this hearing and from other reporting that came out this week that Ratcliffe hopes to be much more aggressive in countering China's growing influence around the world. And that aggressive response will likely include things like spying, different covert operations, clearly the cyber warfare, as well as propaganda campaigns. The last one I wanted to quickly touch on is Marco Rubio. Of course, he is a former senator and had a relatively straightforward hearing before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who was reviewing his candidacy for Secretary of State. He also had tough words for China, which, in his words, has, quote, lied, cheated, hacked, and stolen their way to global superpower status at our expense and at the expense of their own people. So we can very much expect that Rubio will seek a confrontational relationship with the People's Republic of China. And he struck a bit of a softer tone when it came to Ukraine and said that that conflict would require, quote, true diplomacy and concessions from everyone involved. So that's the main things I wanted to highlight for now. So I'll send it back to you, Andrew, for our next bite.
Okay, so President Biden and President-elect Trump each took credit for the Israel-Hamas ceasefire scheduled to begin as early as Sunday. And of the two, Trump may have the stronger claim, despite not yet being in office. Trump's Middle East envoy, Stephen Witkoff, traveled to Israel last week. He met with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and pressured the Israeli leader to agree to a deal, according to reports in Israeli media. Whether the ceasefire will hold or even come into effect is far from certain. But early this morning in Israel, Netanyahu's office announced that his government had finalized an agreement with Hamas. Under the terms of the agreement, Palestinian prisoners will be exchanged for Israeli hostages, and Israeli forces will withdraw from areas of the Gaza Strip. And if all goes well, the temporary ceasefire will become a permanent truce. Trump's apparent diplomatic win raises a big question that we pose in this week's issue of The Earthling, which is the weekend edition of the Non-Zero newsletter. And that question is, if a ceasefire agreement was within reach, why did it elude the Biden administration for so long? As we know, one possible answer to that question came this week during a podcast interview of National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. Ezra Klein of The New York Times asked Sullivan why the Biden administration hadn't done more to pressure Israel and Ukraine to end the wars they're involved in. Both nations rely on U.S. arms to wage their wars, and Klein wanted to know why Biden hadn't used this leverage to help push for peace. And Sullivan's answer was basically that Biden doesn't understand his relationships with those allies in transactional terms, and he didn't think it was appropriate to use his leverage to force them to do things they don't want to do. As we write in The Earthling, Trump is famously transactional and attentive to his leverage, and perhaps that's why his envoy had more success than the Biden White House has had in getting BB to agree to a ceasefire. We'll have more to say about this topic later in our deep dive discussion, but for now, I'll toss it back to you, Connor.
Great. So my next topic, I wanted to talk about something that will be a potential early priority of the Trump administration, which is the administration's threats to bomb cartels that traffic in fentanyl in Mexico and bring that drug into the United States. Mexico, in response, sort of indirect response to this effort from the incoming Trump administration, submitted a brief to the United Nations this week, arguing that such an attack would be illegal under international law. The paper, which does not explicitly mention the United States, rejects the legal doctrine that America has used to justify attacks within foreign countries in the past. And the diplomats said that they hoped that the UN would be able to hold an official discussion on this topic at some point soon. Mexico has long pushed for a greater discussion around this. And this legal theory, which is known as the unwilling or unable doctrine, is fairly straightforward. If, for example, the United States and Al-Qaeda are at war, or the United States and the cartels are considered to be at war, and that group poses some form of threat to the United States, then America argues that if the government of the territory that that group is residing in is, quote, unwilling or unable to do something about that threat, then the United States has the right to take matters into their own hands. This doctrine has fairly significant support in the West and has been used to justify attacks by a number of Western countries, but also Turkey, Israel, the United States, of course, and Russia. And the U.S. uses this often to justify what it calls over-the-horizon strikes, which it has carried out in a number of countries, including Afghanistan since the withdrawal, with the main example being the strike that killed Ayman al-Zawahiri, the former al-Qaeda leader who I believe took part in the planning for the 9/11 attacks in his apartment in Kabul in the summer of 2022. Now, the challenge that many international lawyers say this doctrine poses is that it essentially spreads the battlefield across anywhere in the world. Instead of following the idea that you are fighting within a country, you are following the members of that non-state group, and wherever they happen to be could, in theory, under this doctrine, be a battlefield where the U.S. or any other country could launch a direct attack on them. A more specific problem for the Trump administration will be the fact that there is no kind of reading of the current relationship between the United States and the cartels in which one could argue that they are in an act of war. Trump may attempt to put a different gloss on that and argue that they are indeed at war and that the cartels pose an imminent threat to the United States, both of which are key preconditions for such attacks like these. But it really will depend on how the lawyers are willing to interpret that. And we'll have to see, for example, if Congress is willing to pass an authorization for the use of military force, which would give a much stronger argument for the Trump administration in its argument that we are indeed at war with the cartels. So this is a topic that we will be obviously following fairly closely in coming months. So something we'll keep an eye on. But for now, I will send it back to Andrew for our next bite.
The U.S. government's looming TikTok ban has sparked a mass migration of users to the Chinese app Zhaohongshu, which means little red book, but is called Red Note by American users. As we write in The Earthling, U.S. lawmakers likely hadn't intended the TikTok ban to boost a rival app named after a book of quotations by Mao Zedong, the Chinese communist revolutionary. In April, Biden signed into a law a bill that forces ByteDance, the Chinese company that owns TikTok, to either sell the app to a non-adversary of the U.S. or see it banned in America. Lawmakers who supported the ban say that China could use the platform to spy on Americans and manipulate public opinion, while critics say the ban infringes on the free speech rights of Americans under the First Amendment. Since ByteDance hasn't sold the app and since the Supreme Court hasn't intervened to block a ban, TikTok is scheduled to go offline this Sunday in America. Though this morning, right before we started taping, we saw reports that Biden may decline to enforce the ban and leave it to Trump to figure out what to do. And Donald Trump opposes the TikTok ban and is reportedly considering ways he can delay enforcement. And I learned today that the CEO of TikTok has even been invited to attend Trump's inauguration and sit in a position of honor on the inaugural platform, which kind of surprised me. Trump has a large following on TikTok, which might be, you know, one big reason he wants to save the platform if possible. And he used to be very critical of it. In The Earthling, we linked to a CNN report, which I found quite interesting, about how Red Note has become a hub of interaction between American and Chinese young people now that so many so-called TikTok refugees have decamped to the platform. You know, Chinese users are getting help on their English homework. American users are doing their best to be respectful. They're encouraging their compatriots to be respectful guests, as the report said. And one tech analyst told CNN that, quote, users are finding creative ways to transcend language barriers, navigate cultural differences, and coexist in fascinating ways, end quote. And with that, I'll toss it back to you, Connor.
Donald Trump is obviously the main topic of many things we're talking about, but one thing that might surprise you is that he is returning to the Oval Office with a very significant amount of support within the Global South, according to a new poll from the European Council on Foreign Relations. We have a great graph on this in this week's Earthling, and I might try to get our wonderful producer, Clark, to put that graph up for those of you watching on YouTube. But in short, it shows that majorities in India, China, and Saudi Arabia say that, on balance, Trump will be good for peace in the world, as do a plurality of respondents in Russia, South Africa, and Brazil. In fact, in another question they asked, most people surveyed in many of these countries believed that Trump would also be a net good for U.S. citizens, with the notable exception of just about every country in Western Europe. But the most interesting results may have come with regards to Ukraine and South Korea, two countries where Trump is going to have an opportunity to make a big impact on policy going forward, and two countries in which he is trying to seek some form of an end to an ongoing conflict. So in Ukraine, 33% of respondents told the European Council on Foreign Relations that Trump would be a good thing for peace in the world, while 18% said that he would be bad for peace. Obviously, that leaves a large plurality of 49% who said they weren't so sure about how Trump might approach this. And I think that we can interpret this result as very cautious optimism from Ukraine ahead of expected peace talks. I would note that Russia had a much more positive take, with only 10% of respondents saying that Trump would be bad for peace and 45% saying that he'd be good. Obviously, that still leaves 45% saying that they're not sure, but you know, that's an interesting finding. Meanwhile, in South Korea, fully 50% of respondents said that Trump would be bad for peace, while 17% said that he would be good. This is an interesting indicator ahead of sort of expected efforts from Trump to seek some sort of arrangement in which either tensions are lowered between North and South Korea, or between North Korea and the United States, or maybe even a path towards a genuine peace deal to end the conflict that is technically ongoing on the Korean Peninsula. So all of that is very interesting data. I encourage people to go check out the poll in more detail, but for now, I'll send it back to you, Andrew.
An investigation by the Washington Post found that at least 8 Americans have been wrongfully arrested because of false matches produced by AI-powered facial recognition software, and by the tendency of some police officers to treat the results produced by such software as infallible. So these people who were wrongly arrested, you know, they didn't have any connection to the crime being investigated. They weren't found near the crime scene. They didn't know the victim. They didn't have a motive. They would never have been treated as a suspect if not for the fact that some AI software spat out their name as a match for images, often unclear, grainy images of the actual suspect. I'll note that anyone who's used ChatGPT has probably noticed that chatbots, unless you are careful in how you prompt them, have a tendency to give you a nonsense answer rather than to say, I don't know the answer. And it seemed to me, you know, reading this investigative report, that something like that is going on here with this software. I think the company that produces a lot of the software is called, is it Clearview AI? I should have looked into that earlier. But it seemed to me that this was one thing going on. And police in at least 12 states have used, you know, AI-powered facial recognition technology to identify and arrest suspects, according to the Post, though most police departments aren't required to disclose their use of the technology. So that number is likely higher, the true number. So, Connor, I think it's time now to transition to our deep dive discussion of the Gaza ceasefire and why Trump was apparently able to achieve a diplomatic breakthrough that has eluded the Biden administration. During the news bite on this topic, I didn't have time to mention something that we both found pretty interesting and that we wrote about in today's Earthling, and which gives an indication of the kind of pressure that Trump's team is evidently willing to put on Netanyahu. Last week, Stephen Witkoff, Trump's Middle East envoy, was in Qatar, where a lot of the diplomacy around the Gaza war has been happening. And on Friday evening, he called Netanyahu's office and informed the prime minister's aides that he was traveling to Israel the next day for a meeting with Netanyahu. You know, he just kind of, when I say he informed them, I mean, Netanyahu didn't realize such a meeting would be taking place. And the reports that I read didn't say that he requested a meeting. It was put like this. He told them a meeting was going to happen. And that's already interesting, you know, it's pretty short notice. But the story gets more interesting. The aides explained that the meeting would have to wait until after Shabbat, the Jewish holy day of rest. But according to one Israeli journalist who writes for Haaretz, Witkoff, quote, explained to them in salty language that Shabbat was of no interest to him, end quote. The salty language seems to have been effective. Netanyahu did indeed meet with Witkoff on Saturday during Shabbat, and the two hammered out an agreement. And Witkoff then went back to Qatar to seal the deal. And then this week, we've learned from various sources that there is an agreement that Israel and Hamas, you know, have come to. And it seems now even Israel is you know, formally announcing this, or at least getting close to doing so, as I was looking at this morning. So I just wanted to know those details, which I found interesting. But Connor, what do you have to say about this topic?
Yeah, I think, well, what really jumps out about all of this is obviously the way in which, you know, Trump obviously has, in certain ways, a closer relationship with Netanyahu than Biden does. But also just Trump's kind of willingness to use leverage is such a huge distinction between Biden and Trump. And I think it's a particularly interesting way. I think it's not just a willingness to use leverage, or indeed even a willingness to use leverage with allies. But, you know, Biden throughout the the course of his administration has shown a really unique sort of lack of desire to use leverage with allies that are at war, that are involved in conflicts, right? You know, when the question is, are we going to put, in order to compete with China, all kinds of restrictions on the export of U.S. chips, including to some American treaty allies, that's less of a problem. But when it has to do with war, that's an area where Biden has shown a real kind of discomfort in putting any pressure. And I don't have a great answer for why exactly Biden takes that tack, but it's very interesting. He seems and has been so unwilling to just add pressure and to advocate for a rapid end to the war, perhaps because he's afraid of the political blowback, both in the cases of Ukraine and Israel. But at the same time, I mean, you've got Trump going ahead and just doing this, and you've got Republicans seemingly going along, and you've got some anger within Israel. You've got some more kind of strong, hardline sort of Zionist members of the Israeli cabinet going and saying, oh, well, I think this has gone too far. This is dangerous, whatever. But by and large, it looks like there's a real chance that at least the first phase of this ceasefire will go into effect, which is kind of a miracle. And it's more or less the same deal that was on the table back in April. So, yeah, I think it's just such a remarkable contrast.
Yeah, I think the point that you made about Biden's, you know, domestic political calculus is very important, because that seems to be what has left him kind of hamstrung in dealing with the crisis in Israel, even more so than the crisis in Ukraine, I think. And that's what's kind of strange about Trump's willingness to go forward with this, because, you know, he's got even more kind of right-wing Zionist figures around him than exist in the Democratic Party. But evidently, maybe it's just because he has more political capital right now as his second term is about to begin. I don't know the answer to that question exactly, why he felt liberated to do this. I'll also say maybe it's a little unfair to Biden to give all of the credit to Trump. I do think the Biden administration has been, you know, accelerating efforts to get to a ceasefire agreement, because, you know, they want to get that done before they leave office, just if nothing else for the sake of their legacy. You know, there's also been changes in the geopolitics of the region. Israel is in a stronger position relative to Iran, for example, and relative to some militant groups that are, you know, allied with Iran. So all of those factors, I think, matter for why this agreement took place. But it is pretty obvious that Trump's election and his, you know, soon to be inauguration was perhaps the biggest factor for why this this happened now. Again, on the political calculus, I want to highlight this frankly stunning stat that our producer Clark McGillis found this week. A YouGov poll from the Institute for Middle East Policy Understanding found that 1 in 4 Americans who voted for Joe Biden in 2020, but not for Kamala Harris in 2024, said that ending Israel's violence in Gaza was the top issue affecting their voting decision. You know, 25% is a very large number in this context. That was a higher percentage than for any other issue listed, higher than for the economy, for example. I think the economy was just one issue, and ending Israel's violence in Gaza ranked higher. I don't know what the distribution of these voters is. I don't know how well represented they are in battleground states. I don't want to say that this shows that, you know, Kamala Harris would have won the election if she had signaled that that she was going to like push for an end to the war. And of course, you know, the Biden administration, the Harris campaign, as I was saying, they have this political calculus where, you know, they're also getting hammered from people on the right and, yeah, you know, for being insufficiently supportive of Israel. So who knows how would it have played out if they had been more critical of Israel or willing to actually do something about Israel's behavior that they were criticizing. But to me, the way that they handled this whole situation, it must have been suboptimal. You know, there were so many instances where it seemed to me that they were being too clever by half. You know, they were drawing a red line, but they're not really enforcing it. They were releasing, you know, leaking to the media that Biden has called Netanyahu an asshole. It's like, how many times can you do that before people just stop caring? It's having no effect, clearly. They did that thing where they said that they were going to cut military shipments to Israel if it didn't surge humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip. They clearly set the deadline for that. after the election. And then when the deadline came and Israel hadn't done what they had requested, they didn't do anything about it. So they were trying to play it both ways, and it just made them look weak.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one real distinction here, too, between Trump and Biden and Trump and Harris is that Trump just has a really impressive ability to sort of shape these top line narratives around issues. You know, he hammered the Biden administration for this idea of chaos in the world, chaos in the streets of America, chaos at the border, chaos in the Middle East and in Ukraine. It was like this that locked into this narrative, right, in a way that the Biden administration kind of in its response and in the Harris campaign's response was all about these sort of like, oh, okay, well, we'll deal with this in this or that way. It didn't have the same punch that, you know, the overly simplistic but apparently effective narrative that Trump put forth did, right? And now, you know, the question of whether Trump or Biden gets credit for this, I mean, it's got to be Trump. There's simply no doubt that Trump is going to be the one that gets credit because he understood, in this case, the importance of the idea of like entering office on a big win, right? So he clearly sent Witkoff to the Middle East and he was having in mind like, this has to end before I get into office. And that's going to provide this big springboard. And it's going to be a big thumb in the eye of the Biden administration. So, I mean, it just really, it is the main thing that's impressive about Trump as a politician is that he just like no one else. Maybe, I mean, Obama was also good at this, but it's a rare politician that's able to set narratives and set almost vibes throughout the culture in the way that Trump does.
Yeah, he does have. This is one of his many unique abilities, I would say. I'm curious, you know, do you think that if Biden had taken this approach, it would have yielded the same positive result? Like if it had been Antony Blinken who told Netanyahu, I don't care about Shabbat, I'm coming to your office tomorrow and we're going to talk about a deal and I'm getting concessions from you that you've previously resisted, which seems to be what Witkoff did. Do you think if Biden had gone that route, it would have worked, or would the politics have played out differently and Netanyahu wouldn't have been so cowed?
I mean, after the election, it wouldn't have worked, right? I don't think. I think after the election, there was always just the specter of Trump hanging over everything. But before the election, I think maybe, right? You know, Israel really does, to a significant extent, rely on the United States for the prosecution of this war. We provide them with not just weapons, but also lots of intelligence in order to kind of help locate hostages and do different things like that. And I think that Israel really doesn't have a ton of a choice but to listen to the U.S. if the U.S. is willing to put its foot down. I mean, part of the problem there is that, you know, I could maybe see Sullivan doing that, but Blinken, that's just so at odds with the way that he presents himself to the world because he's so focused on being sort of the he's been so focused over the past 4 years in being the like nice America, the America that goes out and that helps its allies and that works with its allies. And it's this like it's this upbeat story about America that may have worked at one point, but just does not seem to be clicking anymore. And I just have such a hard time picturing him, you know, laying into Netanyahu. It's almost impossible to get in my head.
Yeah, I guess don't get me started on Blinken. Yeah, you know, when I was listening to that Jake Sullivan interview with Ezra Klein's interview of Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor, I was struck that, you know, Jake Sullivan, when I'm listening to him, I feel like there is like a working intelligent mind there. Like, I don't find it embarrassing that he's like the national security advisor and the country in which I live. Obviously, I have criticized the Biden administration's foreign policy. I think they've made a lot of mistakes. But I think he's sensible and kind of strategic in his thinking, and he seems thoughtful. Like he's asked a question, he like considers it, and he says something that makes sense. Blinken is just, and I think the problem has gotten worse in recent months. He's just every sentence is like a cliche. Every sentence that comes out of his mind, he's so platitudinous. I get the sense of like tiredness from some of these officials. Like they're just ready to be done with this. We're seeing them kind of. There's this push to sort of defend Biden's foreign policy legacy and kind of influence the discourse about the legacy Biden is leaving behind. But some of the stuff is kind of painful to watch. Did you see I think it was today, maybe it was yesterday, actually, Biden was asked by a reporter during a press conference. I think he was flanked by both Blinken and Kamala Harris. He was asked whether he or Trump deserved credit for the ceasefire. And he just kind of turns around and smirks and says, is that a joke? So maybe he actually sees it that way, but it definitely the perception in the media, including liberal outlets, is that Trump got this done and Biden was too weak to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe we should end this discussion on a bit of a note of caution, to just to say that, you know, obviously this ceasefire agreement, I think, is welcome to everyone. There's been huge celebrations within Gaza. There's been major attention paid to this, especially by the families of the hostages mm-hmm. within Israel. And you don't want to kind of dampen that enthusiasm. But it's important to note that this is a phased ceasefire agreement, that the ceasefire agreement that we saw in Lebanon has been repeatedly violated, that has not really been followed. There are still Israeli forces within Lebanon, to my knowledge, as far as I know. And then, you know, this has the 6-week phase thing. And then there's always a chance that, you know, either Hamas does something during that period that Israel can kind of hook into and say, hey, we need to respond to this. And then it slowly starts rolling, or that Israel just decides that they, you know, that they want to go back in and that they can't stomach the idea of Hamas being in power and that they'll go right back. So I'm a little hesitant to say that this is, you know, that the war in Gaza is over, right? Mm-hmm. But this is just by far the best kind of moment of hope that we've had in quite a long time.
Yeah, I think in late 2023, there was a week-long ceasefire that allowed some exchange of hostages and prisoners. Yeah.
That had no path towards a full truce.
Right.
Yeah.
But you're right to you know, express caution here. I saw the incoming National Security Advisor Mike Waltz was being interviewed, and when he was asked about the ceasefire, you know, his answer gave the impression that he doesn't think this war is over and that Israel ultimately needs to destroy Hamas. And you can imagine all sorts of things, like if a militant group that's not Hamas engages in some violent skirmishes with Israeli forces, is the ceasefire going to be considered, you know, at an end? What happens if Hamas declares victory and Netanyahu's embarrassed by that? You know, any number of things could happen that could complicate this. But, you know, as early as Sunday, it's supposed to go into effect. It does seem like the Israeli government is, you know, approving the ceasefire today. So that's good news. And we'll see what happens next.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is probably the right moment for us to bring on our ever esteemed guest and boss, Robert Wright. Bob's going to be joining us for the second half of this conversation. We probably will come back and talk a little bit more about Gaza, sort of almost inevitably about sort of the legacy of the Biden administration, both when it comes to foreign policy and to AI policy. And we also have an update that's a bit of sad news for Non-Zero, but I'll save that for when Bob joins. So in the meantime, let's send it over to that conversation.
Cool. Bob, how's it going?
Can't complain. How are you guys?
How's doing well. We had another excellent episode of Non-Zero World. You'll be happy to hear.
Wait, the episode's not over yet. Let's reserve judgment.
Oh, yeah, true. I'm getting ahead of myself.
That's right. Things are pretty much on the verge of going sideways at any moment, so we need to keep an eye out for that.
In fact, a recent addition to the crew could lead things in exactly that direction. So, should we start out with the bad news? I mean, as long as you ask, the honest answer to your initial question is I'm very sad and depressed.
Why is that, Bob?
It's because I don't think this comes as news to you, Andrew, but you're leaving.
I am. Yes. Should I talk about that? I'm going to become the senior editor at Breitbart. No, I'm just kidding. No. Something less shocking to the sensibilities of our Non-Zero heads. I'll be a senior editor at the American Conservative beginning January 27th. So I am sadly departing Non-Zero News.
Yeah, it is sad. I mean, the good news is, A, you're staying in the foreign policy journalism business, and B, you're going to a place whose foreign policy ideology I largely approve of. I mean, I'm not of course, when it comes to domestic politics, I'm not known as a conservative, but there is a variant of conservatism, sometimes called paleoconservative, sometimes called Buchananite conservatism. And Pat Buchanan founded the American Conservative, of course.
He did. He co-founded it in part because he wanted a conservative outlet that was against the Iraq War to kind of compete with the National Review and other kind of mainstream conservative outlets.
Yeah. So there's like, you know, 80% overlap between my foreign policy worldview and the paleoconservative. Yeah. So this is much better than, you know, my having worked so hard over the last couple of years to raise your IQ by, I don't know, 30, 40 points. Hey, Andrew, and then have you like go to Wall Street or something and just use it to make money and not make the world a better place.
That's true. Yeah. And you did. I don't know if you raised my IQ. I don't know if you can raise someone's IQ with
you can.
With education.
You can.
Oh,
you
really?
It's already happened. Then.
You are living.
You can't decline
proof.
It.
Well, I don't want to spend too much time on this.
I think we should do the whole. I think we should have a series.
You just got quieter, by the way. I don't know if something changed with your mic. But yeah, I don't want it to be like when Paul Pierce retired from the NBA and he wanted to have this whole retirement tour, and then it turned out no one really cared. I don't even remember what team he was playing for at the end of his career in the NBA, but I do remember. After he missed a free throw, Draymond Green said, "You thought you was Kobe?" Because Kobe had this big retirement tour. All the fans were, you know, paying top dollar to see his games. That didn't happen for Pierce.
People got a little tired of Kobe's by the end, I think. But yeah, Paul Pierce was no Kobe. So anyway, we're back after some technical difficulties. And I think the main thing is that generations from now, when people sit around in pubs and play trivia and somebody says, "Who is the person who plucked Andrew Day out of obscurity and catapulted him into the stratosphere of foreign policy discourse?"
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's you. I appreciate the plucking. You wanna move on to the news? I'm curious about, you know, Trump just solved the Gaza war. How excited are you about that development?
Wait, I want to say one more thing related to you, because for one thing, it's an opportunity to remind people that we're hiring. Mm-hmm. Now, we're hiring more than one person. We're hiring at least 1.5 people, maybe two. And I should say, there's a good chance that the full-time journalist we hire will not actually be a foreign policy person, because I want to kind of expand the range of our coverage. Connor is a foreign policy obsessive, of course, and I'm very interested in it. But I'm actually hopeful that then when we do the next hire and get our house in order, even if it is not somebody who's a foreign policy person, if our empire continues to expand as we envision, it will not be long before we add some.
When is the deadline for application submissions?
Well, at the moment, it's the 20th, I think, which is only 3 days.
It's like midnight on Sunday, midnight on the this coming.
So yes, hurry, don't listen to the rest of this. But anyway, it's been a pleasure, Andrew. You've been great. You've been a joy to work with, conscientious, and so on. And if you have to lose someone, I say lose them right after they have their first child and are going to get distracted from their work.
Good business strategy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, what should we talk about?
I want to get your take on Gaza and Trump's apparent diplomatic win and pushing for a ceasefire. Or maybe you would quibble with that characterization. I don't know.
No, I encourage calling it his win, because the more he thinks of it as his baby, the more likely he is to take care of it once he's president. Do not go around quibbling about whose accomplishment this is. Give him full credit, and that makes it more likely that it will endure. It's an open question right now how he's going to handle what will very likely be pressure from at least some parts of Israel's domestic politics to make this thing fall apart. Part of the political spectrum in Israel that Bibi Netanyahu has been known to have sympathy for himself. I'm still a little unclear on the details. I mean, I was glad to hear that the idea is the Gazans repopulate the north, because I honestly thought maybe Israel, now having cleared most of them out, was going to insist on just basically making that part of Israel, in effect, keeping it kind of ethnically cleansed. Now, they don't, a lot of them don't have homes to return to, so we'll see how fast this can happen. But that part's good. I'm a little I mean, assuming, of course, you know, this thing could fall apart at any moment. But, and a lot of people think after the first stage of hostage releases, it'll be particularly fragile because Israel will have gotten a lot of what it wanted. But, you know, the details I'm unclear of on or what is happening with the Philadelphia corridor at the southern end of Gaza. Israel would like to keep occupying that. I've heard different accounts. And then the corridor in the middle, I just can't believe Israel's going to let go of both of those things. Maybe not either. Have you guys heard good reporting on this?
I have not seen really clear things on this, which is concerning, I guess, because it definitely leaves open the possibility that those will be taken again. The corridor in the middle is called the Netzarim corridor after some former settlements that were there before Israel fully withdrew from the Gaza Strip as a civilian entity when Israeli civilians withdrew in 2005, I believe. But I have not seen any super clear indications about whether Israel is going to pull back. I think that this deal would, in theory, certainly the take from the Israeli right, and particularly the Israeli sort of further right, is that this deal amounts to a full sort of capitulation or a full withdrawal from Gaza. So they're getting that reading from somewhere, I guess. That's something that I've definitely seen on X and other social media platforms in recent days. But the big question is whether we even get through this first 6 weeks. Question one is whether it even takes hold on Sunday. Question two is we get through the first phase, and then from there, who knows? Because there's also always the possibility that Israel, you know, if the hostages are indeed all returned, no longer really has any incentive to not go ahead and do more of what they've been doing.
Yeah. I want to file a complaint about the New York Times related to this. And by the way, I just caught a glimpse of myself and saw that I'm wearing these glasses. I want to say these are just in honor of Andrew. These are not real glasses. No, they are. They are real glasses. But I think somebody's got to fill
Connor,
the void.
You were supposed to wear your glasses. Come on, man.
Somebody's got to fill the void that will be left. You can't fill his shoes, but you can wear his glasses. So the New York Times, I thought I read in the New York Times, they said, like, at some point, according to a copy of the agreement obtained by the New York Times. Well, could we see it, please? I mean, the tradition of newspapers not releasing documents like this arose back when it would have cost them a shitload to publish it because they were just physical. What is the reason? What is the reason for not letting us all see it? Because there's going to be these conflicting accounts. There already are. Yes, Israel's supposed to do that. No, they're not. Mm. Why doesn't the New York Times just put it up?
Yeah, I mean, I think that my guess, if I'm going to play defending the New York Times, I agree that they should put those things up. They might argue that it's got challenges like what you saw with Reality Winner and The Intercept back in 2018, I think it was. And this is the member of... Well, yeah, it's just it's getting rid of identifying details so that you make sure that the leak isn't able to be tracked back. And that's sort of a complicated... So there's been arguments that that's a complicated process.
Just have, the New York Times can afford to have somebody just retype the thing. So there are no identifying features of the document.
Although
the
there's different drafts and there's different versions of each draft. So maybe even the language itself would
It may have been a condition under which they obtained it. I don't know. But
they should publish it. Yeah.
Well, or at least answer my question. These are the big questions. Philadelphia corridor, the corridor through the heart of Gaza, and, you know, a few others are the obvious big questions. And the New York Times is not clarifying it for us.
Yeah. Even the broader question of just what the withdrawal of Israeli forces will look like or is supposed to look like isn't clear to me. A lot of the reports say they're withdrawing from areas of the Gaza Strip. It'll be literally that vague. I know that Biden said that they're going to withdraw from population centers in Gaza. Do you guys have a sense of...
Well, I've heard they're retaining the buffer zone around it. So that could account for that language by itself. Mm-hmm. Even if they're not going to occupy... Because otherwise, I would think that means they are going to keep that middle quarter, which I think they will anyway. I honestly do. But there may be that at the very end, they're supposed to relinquish that. And then, you know, some people in Israel will try to make it fall apart before then.
Yeah. I mean, they have built a significant number of permanent seeming structures within that Netzarim corridor in the middle. So there definitely is. There's going to be a lot of pressure within Israeli politics, frankly, to hold on to that part of the strip that is going to be really difficult and really thorny for the Trump administration to deal with.
Yeah. So, you know, the Biden administration is kind of trying to proudly claim this as its legacy. I don't think it's really getting it away with it, not only because apparently Trump exerted some kind of leverage that Biden failed to. I mean, is that, first of all, is that your understanding?
Yeah, we talked about it in the earlier segment. He sent Stephen Witkoff, his Middle East envoy, and this businessman who's been involved in Florida real estate and is a friend of Donald Trump's, a golfing buddy. Yeah, he sent him, and Witkoff used salty language, as Haaretz described it, in demanding a meeting with Netanyahu the next day, even though it was during Shabbat. Oh, yeah. And then he was able to extract concessions from him. Yeah,
I saw that. Okay. Yeah, I mean, the other kind of fail, I think, for Biden legacy purposes is that a lot of people are using it as the occasion to note that Biden had the leverage to get this done a long time ago. If he had if he had just said, no, we're withholding the weapons, he obviously had the leverage. I don't know
if
you saw
it. Well, it's the same deal they were trying to get back in May, right? Literally.
That's what they say. I mean, did you see the video from Blinken's press conference where they had to forcibly eject not one, but two journalists?
Awful. Awful. Mm-hmm. I really genuinely couldn't believe what I was watching. I mean, clearly they were asking, you know, in somewhat belligerent ways, but I mean, just watching the thing is like, seeing a journalist being pulled, you know, like Sam Husseini, I've sat next to him at press conferences before. Like, this is a fixture of the DC, like, think tank, State Department scene. And he was dragged out, like, kicking and screaming.
Yeah. And it's
crazy.
Yeah. We didn't see what happened, like, long before he was dragged out, but it didn't seem to me that he could have been being very disruptive. Because when the video starts, Blinken is giving his remarks seemingly unimpeded, and Husseini's just sitting there. And then the police officers came up to him. Apparently, he had tried to ask a question, but I don't think he was, like, you know, treating the room to a harangue or something. Impression.
Had Max Blumenthal already, and by the way, Max is, of course, no stranger to forcible ejection. I got to say, it was a pretty effective rant he did on the way out. Had he already been ejected?
Doing it first guy? So, I think so.
So maybe the security guards were already, on high alert. But it was, the final part of Max's video. Did you see when Matt Miller, the spokesman, came up and Max says, quit smirking, Matt. You smirked your way through a genocide. I always thought that was the smirking part, at least, was unfair. It's just the way his face is. He's not smirking. Like, I'm not depressed. I just look, I'm happy.
He's sometimes
smirking. He has a resting
smirking.
Smirk.
He has a resting smirk. He has an innate step.
I didn't understand what he was doing in approaching Blumenthal. It looked kind of odd.
It was weird that somebody at that level is going to walk up and, like, I mean, I think, you know, there are professionals here. There are security guards. They've got him. It was odd.
Yeah. Really.
Do you think these encounters, you know, because Blinken also was recently heckled by someone who said he's Secretary of Genocide and Bloody Blinken and stuff like that. Do you think that these events are kind of driving home the point to Blinken that Gaza is a real stain on his legacy? Or do you think he just dismisses
this
stuff?
Well, you know, there was a mainstream journalist, was it 60 Minutes or CNN or PBS, one of those, who asked him, you know, are you, that was probably at least as painful for him as Max Blumenthal screaming at him, was this serious, regular mainstream person said in a very prominent venue, you know, are you afraid that your legacy will be genocide? And he said, well, I don't think it was genocide. At which point, if I had been a journalist, I had said, okay, well, then let's just call it the death of this many civilians that could have been stopped a long time ago, long after any reasonable person thought the continuation of this war was critical to Israel's national security. But that was not the follow-up, of course.
Well, this is why we got to get you back in the mainstream. We got to get you asking.
You don't think it's too late?
I don't think it's too late. I think we could bring you right back.
Yeah. No, I think so. I think, what's the name of the ABC News guy who had the clothespins on his raincoat?
Oh man, I can't believe I forgot.
You're blocking
Muir?
Yeah. I just want to say, I personally think I'm better looking than him. So if it is a cosmetic thing, I don't get it. Like, why is it him and not me? I don't get it.
Mm. Yeah, well, TV producers listening should really ponder this. Should really ponder this. Anyway, so we talked obviously about this kind of Gaza ceasefire, you know, our cautious optimism around it. Are there other aspects of Biden's foreign policy legacy that you might want to dig into, Bob, that you might have thoughts about?
This was a free preview of Non-Zero World. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member at nonzero.substack.com.